Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztraber. On today's show, video games and tech policy. When most people think about the government and video games, the only policy that might come to mind is censorship. You know, we've had these arguments in the past in our society about our video games influencing people and making them violent. And of course, we hear about that in a Hollywood context too, but it's a lot more complicated than that. And whether you're a gamer or someone who's maybe the parent of a gamer, what the government does impact this $30 billion industry. And there's a lot of complexities going on with the policy debates in Washington and how they affect the video game industry. So joining me to discuss this is the perfect person for this topic, Mike Gallagher, President and CEO of the Entertainment Software Association. This is the trade association that represents U.S. computer and video game publishers. Mike, thanks for joining the show.
Evan, thanks for having me, and thanks to the folks at Tech Freedom.
Really appreciate you coming by. So just in a broad sense, if the government's not censoring violent video games, or it's not about, you know, selling them to children, or like all these issues that people might assume are the important things when it comes to video game policy, what is it? Is it taxes? Is it trade?
What's really fantastic is the opportunity to have the discussion go so far beyond censorship. Because the issue portfolio that we manage and lead is dozens of issues. Anything having to do with technology, the internet, or streamed businesses around the world, that's the video game business. We've matured now. It's a $100 billion worldwide industry, $30 billion here in the U.S., 220,000 direct and indirect employees in all 50 states, nearly 3,000 companies are all around the country. It's in, for those of you who have time, look at areweinyourstate.org, and it's a map of every single video game company located down and drilled down by congressional district, and it's an incredible portrait of who our industry really is. So the industry's bigger. The industry's growing very fast. It's very high tech. The average wage is $100,000 a year in this industry, and policy impacts it across the board.
And just so listeners know, full disclosure, I am a gamer, and my household might be a little bit atypical. I have a PlayStation, my roommate has a PlayStation, my roommate also has an Xbox, and he just got a Nintendo Switch. So we've got a few devices running in our house, and of course, broadband is obviously important to all those things working. Now, in Washington, there was this whole thing about healthcare going on, according to the news, and one of the narratives coming out of that is that if Congress decides to move on, the next thing is going to be tax reform. And I know that that affects basically every industry, but why does the video game industry in particular care about what happens to our tax system?
Tax reform is a huge opportunity for our industry because of our high-tech nature, our nature of being an export, and because of the multiplier that 5% of the world's population lives in the U.S. So 95% of the customers are outside the U.S. U.S. is a powerhouse, as I mentioned, for making great video games.
Yeah, it's like one-third of the industry, you could basically say.
Easily. Yeah. And the innovations start here. You talk about virtuality, augmented reality, mixed reality. Those are U.S.-based companies defining the next wave of great innovation in this industry. So if we get the tax policy right, that innovation comes back here in a big way and stays here, creates more wealth and more jobs. And there are some clear places where Congress and the administration are on the right track. And cutting the rates, getting those down to the 15% that's been referenced by several of the leaders, that really is a force multiplier for bringing capital into the U.S. that then's able to put to work to create more of these jobs and these great games, as well as, you know, a lot of our revenues generate off intellectual property. The current tax system distorts that and says that money should be held overseas. All the incentives run contrary to bringing that money home and creating great opportunities here in the U.S. for U.S. workers. So there's a tremendous opportunity for repatriation and lowering the rates.
So video game industry, similar to other, like just your tech companies, you know, more web companies, software companies that we don't think of as video games, more like service providers, cloud services. Similar to those companies, video game companies have this issue of where they store their wealth. And would the benefit essentially be repatriation means more jobs in the United States? Is the video game industry currently doing more stuff overseas, not because it's their number one choice to do that, but because the taxes make it prohibitively expensive to do certain things in the United States?
So it's a very complicated picture, as you can imagine. This is a huge worldwide video game economy. Mary Meeker puts out her annual assessment of the internet, and she dedicated 70 slides of her presentation this year to the video game industry, its historical roots in driving innovation and technology, and where we're going next. And so when you look at those things, all of those trends are going to help us the most if they're centered here in the U.S., where they have been for so long. And when you look at the tax system right now, it says that, first of all, just it's smart to do business around the world. There should be studios around the world. We should be tapping as an industry the worldwide tech ecosystem to pull the very best and brightest to create these experiences that are enjoyed not just here, but in the U.S. We need that. But why should the wealth stay in those markets? Why shouldn't that have an opportunity to come back here? Just picture $1 trillion flowing back into this economy and all of the jobs that could be created around the economy as a whole. But for us, that means there's more income in the pocket of a purchaser of a video game. They're going to buy more. They're going to enjoy more. From a company's perspective, they're going to have an opportunity to invest in that new title, to invest in that new device, and drive everything forward here in the U.S. as opposed to centering that activity somewhere else.
So while there might be some, you know, agreement between Congress and the White House and basically every industry that our tax code is outdated, complicated, doesn't help, and that reforming it would be great, trade is a stickier issue, right? And while there used to be some type of bipartisan consensus, you know, going back to the Clinton years about just free trade generally being a force for good, that is changing not just in the United States, around the world. There's this anxiety that trade, and in particular the tech industry, is leading to job loss or people aren't benefiting from it. So is the video game industry at risk when we talk about things like renegotiating NAFTA, or when we did not end up entering the TPP, and that would have probably been dead even if Hillary Clinton won the election? So how does trade impact the video game industry? Is it because it's global and because I might be playing against someone in another country? Is that what it is? Is it the free flow of data, or is it more than that?
It's more than that. And it really comes down to what are the ground rules for growth on a worldwide basis for this industry? That comes down to trade policy. As I mentioned, 95% of the world's customers are outside the U.S. 2/3 of the world's revenue for the industry is outside the U.S. If we create the right circumstances on a trade basis here, so separate from tax, but just saying the exchanges and the rights and responsibilities we have with other countries, if we get that right, we're able to enlarge our market by leaps and bounds. Picture you, especially in the digital age, it used to be when you made a game, it was a physical product, and it had to be made or printed somewhere and then sold on a shelf, and it physically went into a box, and that's how it was consumed by the gamer,
right,
by the consumer. Now, what happens is you make the game, you invest tens of millions of dollars, it's instantly digitally available worldwide. The power of that is so remarkable for our industry. If we get the rules of the road right, we're driving enormous growth out of an industry that's already on growing with rocket fuel. And so I'll give you a clearer picture of that is on trade, it's important that intellectual property outside the U.S. is respected as much as it is inside the U.S. In the U.S., we have very clear copyright and patent policies. Well, other nations, when they respect our policies and enforce those rules, they're going to create a much better environment for us to grow as an industry and stop a lot of the fraud, hacking, and illegal and illicit activity that could happen overseas. And it does happen overseas.
And there were measures in the TPP that were designed to do this protection of intellectual property. But this is also a big debate within the tech world, where there are many, and I had Mike Masnick on this show talking about it, that think the copyright system is too rigid and that there should actually be more opportunity for creative fair use and things like that. So is there a divide in the video game industry? Because is there kind of a copyright and copy left, or is most of the video game industry very, very strong IP because of how important it is to be able to protect your games and not have them be pirated? I mean, what's the debate there? And essentially, is a trade deal a vehicle for strengthening IP internationally? Is that essentially what the video game industry wants to see out of trade deals like the TPP?
So our industry thrives on creativity. It's the lifeblood, and no one's more creative when it comes to policy than the gamer and the game companies working together. there is a fundamental strand of DNA that separates the video game industry from other players in the tech or the content sector, and that is interactivity. When you have linear media, the media that's consumed in one way.
Like a video.
Like a video or a song. That drives a policy perspective which makes complete sense because the entire experience can be taken and consumed and there's no further relationship with the publisher or the creator of the material.
Yeah.
With games today, the business model that we put in the market, we have many games we give away for free. The price is zero. The concerns around piracy in those games, there are many other concerns like hacking, fraud, copying, and other types of things that happen that are pernicious. But as to the rest of those issues, it's a very different world for our industry. And we have a view that the consumer is the partner in the creative experience, because as you play a game, it's you playing the game. That dialogue between the publisher and the consumer puts us in a much healthier place when we're discussing how to manage the intersection between, as you point out, content and tech when it comes to copyright. Now, if you're looking for where's the best place to put the needle, it's in the Korea Free Trade Agreement. The language that's in there, we believe, strikes the right balance. That's what we'd like to see. And what's encouraging about this administration is they've come out right away with intellectual property protection as being top of the order against China, top of the batting order in NAFTA. Those are things that we can look at as an industry and say there's real opportunity there to make sure we get the rules of the road set so that not only the creators here in the U.S., but the gamers in those countries get access to the great games the rest of the world's playing.
Now, of course, strengthening intellectual property or getting other countries to respect IP of U.S. products in their countries, that might be a benefit. But, of course, there could be a downside with, protectionist rhetoric or just America first-ism in the trade debate where countries retaliate against the U.S. video game industry. You could imagine that, yes, having strong IP is great, but what happens when these exports are the tariffs increase? Or if countries start saying the app store in my country can't have this app? I mean, is there a risk with data localization, with nationalism, that while talking tough on trade might be helpful in the IP sense, that it actually ends up having a downside in the other senses, like export controls and tariffs and things like that?
I think that's where trade associations come in to help close that gap. Look, the board of directors, the major members of ESA, they're from France, they're from Korea, they're from the United States, they're from Japan, and all of those companies run worldwide businesses. I mean, one example, just one person, Owen Mahoney is the CEO of Nexon. He's a former EA executive. His company is publicly traded on the Japanese Stock Exchange, headquartered in Korea, and he lives in the United States and goes amongst those three places. And they're a completely digital company. They don't make a physical product. They're incredibly successful. That's the world that represents where the video game perspective is when it comes to these things. And when you mentioned data, the flow of data is the lifeblood of the gamer experience. From the company experience, it's very, very important. But really for the gamer to enjoy these incredible experiences, if you look at Bethesda Softworks, they make Fallout and Skyrim.
Yep, I'm a fan of both.
These games are phenomenal. I mean, They're massive in the sense of the amount of data that's moving around. For everyone to enjoy that, the data has to move freely across borders. And if it's being held up or there's rules and restrictions about where it can start and where it can end, it kills the experience for the gamer in that country, which is terribly unfortunate. So we participate in these debates and help the government to be able to make these arguments that if you look at the consumer of tomorrow, they're called the gamer of today. And let's track policies and put them in place that maximize the factors that grow that market.
Right. So, of course, you can't play online video games without broadband. And while we were in a world where games were essentially offline and you had a physical system, I still have my old Nintendo or NES and I have my SNES and you've got to blow on the cartridge to get it to work. And that's always fun. But these days, most of the video games I play, it's an online experience. And without an internet connection, your ability to enjoy the video game experience is severely limited. And again, one of the narratives we saw coming out of the election was there are parts of this country that don't have high-speed broadband. They've been left behind, and the economics of broadband are complicated. Now, where do video video games fit into this equation? Are video games a driver of demand for broadband? Is there a connection between demand for video games and whether companies in the broadband space think it's worth it to deploy? And now we're also talking about mobile gaming, and people are using the spectrum, which is a more scarce resource, whereas land-based broadband, you could always, I guess, just build more, right? But spectrum's a scarce resource, and the government has a hand in allocating it. So is that a concern for the video game industry? In order to grow and to have more customers, you need to build out more broadband?
It's not just build it out, but the quality of the broadband is critical. So broadband and internet connectivity has been an incredible force multiplier for the industry. If you think back to the original Xbox when it first came out.
Like 2002?
Thereabouts. It didn't even have ports to connect to the internet, right? The way that you had multiplayer gaming was called plugging in more controllers
intranet,
to the console.
Or you could do a LAN party and have all your friends bring their systems to your house.
Yeah, that's only mildly complicated to set up, right? And so that was the world that existed then, and it took a very short amount of time. Once broadband became widely used across the country and then in other parts of the world, that gaming becomes the number one thing they want to do. Just one example for you on how powerful the force of games are relative to internet connectivity. 80% of the revenue in the Apple App Store and 80% of the revenue in Google Play, 80% is video games.
Right, because those are often the only types of apps that people are willing to pay for. Or they download it for free and it's the freemium model and then they purchase in-app content.
Which is called U.S. video game innovation is what it is. What you have is 80% gamers are driving the future of the mobile ecosystem. That's where the revenue stream's coming from. So for companies and for government that are looking towards what are the policies you need to put in place so that we get to the right place, you might want to make sure you're following how that's developing and maybe use that as an incentive or as a model for how to design policy. So as you know, I was formerly Assistant Secretary of Commerce at NTIA, which is charged with broadband policy for the administration, as well as for spectrum.
Yeah.
And it's broadband equals both. You need to have a really, really robust wired network because somewhere all of this has to hit fiber. Everything that's coming off your cell phone right now when you're using it, if you're watching a video, I guarantee you at some point it's hitting a backhaul link that's on fiber. So you need to have the incentives to build out broadband. And then the quality needs to be good. For us, low latency.
Yeah.
Just picture it. You're the slow guy always moving around in the game. You're going to lose the race every time.
Yeah.
But if you've got super-powered broadband, you're going to be the one that's moving faster. It's best for everybody to have really good low-latency internet. And then on spectrum, the government is uniquely in the position of controlling that resource. It's not just a little bit government-controlled. It's 100% government-controlled. So what you have is how it's allocated, who gets to use it, what are the terms, what happens when you have technological innovations. All of those things are before the FCC and NTIA, and those are critically important to the gamer. That's going to define the future of their experience.
Yeah, and speaking of latency, that's when we think about what does the video gamer want? They want, obviously, cool games. They want to be entertained. But I bet if you were to ask the average video gamer what is the most obnoxious thing, it's the lag, right? I mean, that's the term you hear all the time. You're playing online, and someone who loses a close match, maybe it's a game of FIFA or the game I play a lot, Rocket League, and you beat the other person, and they're like, oh, the only reason I lost is because of the lag, or they're complaining about the broadband in their country. I remember I had one guy who immediately quit the game, and he's like, damn, this Brazilian internet is too slow, right? So you see this all the time. Now, of course, everyone's favorite topic these days is always net neutrality. It's the topic that never goes away. But one thing people might not realize about this debate is that it does relate to video games. And when you have these services that are very sensitive to lag, and just to give a listener an image, think about an activity like clicking Wikipedia links. It's a very bursty activity. The internet traffic is happening in little chunks only when you click the links to go to other pages. But when you think about streaming a live sports match or playing online video games, these are very sensitive. Even the tiniest interruption in connection could really ruin your experience. So we had these strict net neutrality rules under the last FCC. They're going to be repealed under this FCC. Do you see the future of video games, including things like network management, prioritization, even paid prioritization, or is net neutrality too controversial that the industry just doesn't even want to wake the beast?
Well, we just recently filed comments with the Federal Communications Commission that laid out the views from our industry's perspective. And you know, look, we are, in our industry, pro-gamer. And when you look at this from the gamer's perspective, the issues become much clearer. Every consumer deserves fairly priced, robust internet access that gives them access to the information and the entertainment that they want to enjoy. And there ought not be any interference by the ISP.
Like
by
blocking, throttling, discrimination, not the behaviors most often associated with net neutrality regulation, trying to prevent those bad things from happening.
And absolutely. And so our voice was added to many others that says, look, we're for net neutrality on behalf of the gamer and on behalf of the game providers, that it's important that these freedoms cemented in the FCC rules by whatever means is going to be most enduring. It doesn't serve anybody well when it's just a spin cycle of litigation. And that's the chairman's intent. That's what he stated. We provided our view that find the right legal anchor to tie it to and move forward so that we don't continuously have this debate. But really, gamers deserve and providers of games deserve an internet that allows maximum opportunity and that adheres to those principles about the ISPs not interfering with the experience of the gamer or the game provider.
Now, could there be a consumer benefit to quote-unquote non-neutral arrangements, as controversial as they might be? You know, Nicole Turner Lee, a scholar at Brookings, recently was on a panel about trying to figure out a bipartisan arrangement with net neutrality, and she's saying, look, there are certain services like telemedicine, you know, that are maybe they should be prioritized, and maybe, you know, people in Congress don't think of video games as a special service that needs special treatment, but you just brought up how the demand drives broadband deployment. So maybe people should take video games more seriously. But is there a potential benefit to quote unquote non-neutral arrangements, or is the risk too great, or is it a zero-sum game? I mean, I'm just trying to see if, you know, in a world where providers, are, you know, internet providers are allowed to experiment with video game companies, if there's a potential pro-consumer arrangement that is not anti-competitive or does not, you know, violate net neutrality.
So a couple things to keep in mind. One is that it's really important that the rules that do get put in place don't stifle innovation. And the government is uniquely capable of stifling innovation.
You don't say.
So from our perspective, you do need to have protections and rules of the road. But then within that, you have to allow maximum creativity. So whatever rule the FCC moves forward with, I'll give you a few thoughts. This is still very much in motion.
Yeah.
This is being debated at the commission. I think we're in the reply cycle on the comments.
August 16th.
So I'll share with you my personal thoughts right now, because we obviously haven't spoken as an industry on this subject yet. And we're still listening to our members and making sure that we get the balance right within it. But I think there are a few things that are pretty obvious. Is it's too early to tell, I would think, whether some of these things are actually causing that much harm. And business models change. I've been in my job just over 10 years. 10 years ago, virtually no companies were giving games away for free.
Right.
Today, that's one of the most profitable ways to distribute video games is free.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone had said we should not allow free distribution of video games 10 years ago, that would have been a complete mistake. It would have stopped the growth of this industry today. It would have been a horrible example around the world. It would have ceded opportunity to other countries to innovate where we have not. But we didn't do that, right? We don't have those types of rules here in the U.S. So I'd suggest that we need to have some sense of humility when we approach these things, that make sure we leave the doors open for great things to happen. Now, with that in mind, there's another side to this. Is that the internet service providers ought not see this type of rule as a way to just cement or make automatic or by default a price increase. And that's important that the rules might be able to take that into account, that it doesn't just mean it's a pass-through on a price increase, depending on which one of these variables on these sub-policies you mentioned.
Right.
That wouldn't be a good idea. We also ought not dumb down the, not just the internet as it exists today, but the quality and growth curve that it's on. And it's very hard to know what that is because we don't know what the future is. But the point is, it's been getting better and better and better, and the pricing's been fair to declining as we've gone along.
Yeah, in other words, you
get more speed for less money. Well, that type of progression should continue, and whatever policy the commission puts in place, ought not dim that and say that that's now the baseline that everybody has to work from. That would be a mistake.
Yeah, so we talked about things that might benefit the industry from a policy standpoint, like better tax policy, which encourages repatriation, or trade deals that drive other countries to protect intellectual property, or building more broadband. These would all be benefits to the industry. Do you see any threats, you know, on policies, whether it's government surveillance, whether it's taxes, whether it's data localization? I mean, what keeps your industry concerned such that it feels the need to have a trade association to represent its interests before the government?
Well, the good news is that our industry is really, the mission is to extend and protect the frontiers of the interactive entertainment industry worldwide. And the great news is there's frontiers. I mean, we're so incredibly optimistic because we know, as much as we've innovated to get to where we are today, we are redefining the interface between humans and machines. That's what our industry does. And we're not doing it in a government lab, and we're not doing it in a university. We're doing it in the hands and in the homes of consumers. It's incredibly powerful. So we see so much excitement. When you look at Mary Meeker's summary of where the internet is, she says, look to the video game industry to see the future of the internet. And right now, today, we only have 2.6 billion gamers. That means we have about 5 billion more to go.
Yeah.
The frontiers are very, very exciting. So we're very optimistic, and it's our job as an industry association to point our compass in that direction. And yeah, we also do look after some of the things that could slow us down. And so when you look at privacy regulations around the world that can be used or manipulated to just protect a certain market, that's a mistake. We ought to be careful about that. The same thing with data localization and the types of friction there. Cyber and hacking are profound threats throughout our economy. We're no exception. Many of our members have been the victims of hacking. Very, very significant threat. So we have other things that can happen that would, anything that would impede the flow of the digital economy is a bad thing. And let me tell you, that could start right here at home. Chicago, the city of Chicago, has recently passed a 9% streaming tax on entertainment. They took a tax that used to be applied to carnivals and rodeos. And by rule, they changed it and said it applies to Netflix and video games.
Yes, of course.
So we've sued
exactly the same
under the Internet Tax Freedom Act and said you can't do that.
Yeah, the whole point of the Internet Tax Freedom Act, and we talked about it on the show before, is non-discrimination. You're essentially taking something and you're saying because it's streaming, it's 9%. Well, there's other things you can use the internet for. Is there an email tax? Are we going to say that there's a FaceTime tax? I mean, yeah, the possibilities are crazy.
And that's what Chicago has put in place, and we're going to stop them. That's our job. That's what trade associations do.
I like it.
Well, we're fired up. Gamers, they pay attention. Give you an example. We have over 3 million people that follow ESA on social media, on our various social media accounts. 3 million. We're the trade association. We're the most boring part of this industry. But 3 million people care.
Yeah.
So the voice of the gamers, that's who we're helping in Chicago, and we couldn't be more excited to do it, and we're going to win.
Well, I've been to your office, and you guys are not boring at all. So I'll just say that. But to close out the show, is there a message you'd like, you know, your elevator pitch to lawmakers about, you know, what they should be thinking about or what they should be doing in regards to the video game industry? You know, if you were in an elevator maybe for 30 seconds with a congressman and had to try to tell him why you're important, what would you say?
The future of innovation, the future of the economy, and the most exciting things that lie ahead are manifested in video games. Ask your kids.
All right. That's a great pitch, and I'm sure their kids are gaming. So we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining. My guest has been Mike Gallagher, President and CEO of the Entertainment Software Association, better known here in D.C. as ESA. And this is the trade group that represents U.S. computer and video game publishers. Mike, thanks so much for a great discussion.
Thanks, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media at techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because we'll help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.